Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of the London Elections Podcast in association with Little Atoms. With me, Josh Nico. And this week we are discussing issues about youth engagement in the elections, discrimination, identity and diversity. And I've got a fantastic panel this week. Kenny Amaphadon, who produced 3 Kenny reports on youth issues and politics and is now Partnerships and Programmes Director of youth engagement organisation Bite the Ballot. Shelley Asquith, who is the Vice President Welfare of NUS and formerly a Student Union President of the University of the Arts. Dia Chakravarti, who came to London to study at 17 and has lived in London full-time since she was 24, as the Political Director of the Taxpayers Alliance. And Amelia Gachinga, who grew up and lives in Newham and is the Take Back the City candidate for City and East. I'd like to start on the issue of youth participation in these elections, which has been low since the Office of Mayor was created in 2000. The one figures we have, Maury polls before the 2000 election, suggesting only about 27% of 18 to 24 year olds said they were going to vote. Kenny, from your work with Bite the Ballot and before, how would you analyse this problem and what's the best way of dealing with it?
I guess one of the biggest issues is the fact of awareness. So a lot of young people are not aware of the fact that there's an election happening in the first place. So the recent poll by Hope Not Hate and Ben and Jerry shows that 4 in 10 young people have said that basically they're not aware that an election's going to happen in May. And I think for me, and for Bite the Ballot, that's a very scary thing, the fact that people don't know this election's happening. At the same time, it's also because they've not been engaged with and there's not really that much material out there or conversations happening about the upcoming mayoral elections. That's been drowned by the EU referendum. So anything politics that anyone knows about is the EU. So that's drowning out the sound of local elections or the mayoral.
Whose job is it? Is it politicians themselves or elements of bureaucracy who are running the elections, or is it a wider task for media and for London public as a whole to do this?
I guess it's everybody's got a joint responsibility. I think it's easy to blame politicians to say they're not engaging with this particular group, but they can't engage with every single person. However, I guess civic society and the media have a responsibility to actually make people aware about these elections that are coming up, and also really targeting resources with organisations such as Bite the Ballot who can actually engage with that target demographic. There's no point getting the same dull organisations having these massive resources and they don't engage with a group which is massively underregistered.
Dia, what is your experience and feelings about this?
I think Kenny's absolutely right that it is everybody's responsibility. That's the only way it's ever going to work. From my organisation, what we like to do is speak as much as we possibly can with universities and even sixth form colleges, and try and go to schools and the various sort of politics and economics clubs that some of the schools have, and try to make people feel that they have a stake in whatever policy decision is being made, often in their names.
Would it help them in 16-year-olds to vote?
Well, I think that's certainly an interesting idea, but it's also important that we take the information to 16-year-olds. You know, it's not enough to just say they have the very important responsibility of going and voting, but if we're not making them engaged, if we're not providing them with information when they're interested in it, I'm not sure how much that's actually going to achieve.
How informed do you find younger people at school as opposed to people in their 20s? Is there a drop-off maybe as well?
It varies quite a bit, actually. I find that often when you're actually going to speak to, say, politics fairs, I've done that a fair few times, local comprehensive schools who are probably interested in politics and that sort of those sort of issues, there's a huge amount of interest and huge amount of engagement as well. It's nice to see that, and they ask you very difficult questions and they put you on the spot. It's very interesting. Sometimes what you can find, though, is that when somebody's not generally interested in politics as a person, it might be harder to engage with those young people. And I suppose that's where schools may have a role to play, where everybody, you know, has some sort of involvement in these sort of issues, because after all, it affects all of us.
I mean, what's your experience in East London and elsewhere?
Yeah, well, with Take Back the City, what we've been doing is building manifesto, which we've entitled the People's Manifesto, by meeting many different groups across London. And many of these people that we've met are students. And we've been running workshops in schools, colleges and universities where we talk to often depoliticised or unengaged people about, you know, what do you want for a better London? But we start off with questions like, do you know who Boris Johnson is? And it would be like, yeah, that guy with the hair. You know, it will start off like that, and it'll be like, you know, talking about inequality in the city. What are you and your family's experiences of living in this city? How, you know, and then how is it related to the political system? And, you know, do you feel that you have a say and you're represented in this system? And no is the answer to that. And to the people that, you know, to the young people that aren't voting, like, I say, I don't blame you, really. That's what I've been saying, because politics in our city has become really far removed from our daily experiences, and the representation that we're seeing in Parliament, you know, and our mayor are not representative of the regular Londoner, yet alone the regular young person growing up in, like, inner city London.
So you would say part of the answer is better candidates.
We want candidates that come from our communities, who know what is needed in their communities to be the leaders and to run for election. That's what we hope for. We've gone the extra mile by, like, doing poetry on buses. I've been going on the top decks of buses and reciting a poem that I made with my friend Rowan. He's from Brixton. He's a spoken word artist. And we've been saying, oh, hi, guys. Like, we just want to share something with you about our reality in London. And, yeah, just if you want to listen, thank you. Like, and we've recited that poetry. And young people are, like, applauding. Young people are like, yes, this is exactly what we need. And I explain that I'm standing for election. And they're like, thank you so much. That's amazing.
More poetry and maybe musical appearances from the leading candidates.
Not only appearances, it's engagement through art. This is the cultural hub of the world. It needs to happen that way.
Shelley, one of the key recent political issues has been the implementation of individual electoral registration in December, which has seen a disproportionate number of young people fall off registers because of their mobile situation, particularly for students. What's your insight into how students at London universities and colleges are their position for these elections?
Yeah, well, like 10% of London's population are students, so part of my membership. And I think there's an argument to say that these people are disenfranchised with politics, but actually, I think this government has actively tried to disenfranchise them. With the changes to the voter registration, it means that the hundreds of thousands of students that live in halls of residence, for instance, when they started in September, the halls and the universities universities used to be able to block register them, every single student, but now they have to do it individually. They have to go out of their way to actually sign up. And when you're coming to London for perhaps a term, a year, 3 years, not only do you not have as much of investment to take part in the political process as somebody who's lived here all their lives or are planning to stay here, but you also don't necessarily know about it, you don't know about the system, and so I think that's a real issue, and that's going to really see involvement drop. But just going back to the stuff around people who are going to be first-time voters, I remember in 2011, in the lead-up to the last Mayor of London election, me and a bunch of other young people went around to sixth form colleges in London, and we spoke about the different candidates, the different issues. And people say that these young people don't know anything about politics, but they absolutely do. They asked us such challenging questions. They knew exactly about all the issues. And it was more about having someone young standing in front of them who could relate to what they were going through, who knew what it was like to lose their EMA and so on. And that's how I think we need to engage people. I think there is a problem of representation where politicians don't look or sound like us. And I think that's why we need kind of like young ambassadors going out and talking to people about politics. But we do need to address the voter registration issue as well.
Do we need more young politicians too, coming onto the Assembly perhaps, or younger mayoral candidates?
I think that's great, but I think you don't necessarily have to be young to understand and listen to what young people have to say. I think it's not necessarily about...
For example.
Yeah, it's not necessarily about identity. It's about actually appreciating what young people are saying when they talk about tuition fees or talk about housing or talk about police racism, and rather than just dismissing them.
The tone of this race has been characterised increasingly of something that has concerned and provoked many commentators in media and politics, not simply over the Zach Goldsmith campaign's accusation against Sadiq Khan for giving cover to extremism and all of the potential overtones of that relating to race and religion, but also through the targeting of particular ethnic groups of voters by the Goldsmith campaign, and arguably as well by Sadiq Khan's identification of his own immigrant story and his particular identity of being able to fight extremism. So identity politics appears to have been playing this major role. How much does this concern you as an issue, Kenny?
I don't know, I think you kind of missed the mark. I don't think it's identity politics, I just think it's a case of people are playing the whole fear-mongering politics, really. It's really to say one person saying this other person is scary. And I don't think it's got anything to do with even the two front runners. It's just becoming politics as we're continuing in this sort of time. With the last general election, we saw a lot of scaremongering with the Scottish referendum and the mayoral elections. There's no difference. People are using fear as a means to get people to vote a particular way in terms of looking at what people are afraid of. For example, even with the whole Sadiq and the actual extremist links, that's actually someone who's a constituent, first and foremost. Yep. He's actually even a conservative, and he's actually been in photos of also with Zach Goldsmith.
Mm.
However, if you look at it in the small context of David Cameron and PMQs taking that opportunity, you'd think something else. That's the problem. People are getting sort of celebrity politics gossip and just pushing things out and hoping that people sort of consume it.
Is there any way around this politics, fear and sort of superficial approach to politics?
No, of course, that just depends on the candidates and who's really trying to... I don't know, people sort of don't understand the message of actually hope, and what you actually want to do is much more... will resonate with much more of young people by actually just saying, look, this is what I want to do. You can't just want to stand because I don't want this other person to win.
It's... Can I... Yeah, I just, like, yeah, what you're saying is, like, my wavelength. And, yeah, divisive politics, negative politics... We're sick of it. In fact, I feel like everyone's fallen deaf to it. And the reason why people aren't voting a lot of the time is because they are sick of this kind of, like, fear-mongering that we're having. And, yeah, like, with Take Back the City, we've always been like, we are Londoners and we're united in the resistance that we're having against the cuts or against, you know, the inequality that that we are facing. And our common stories, we need to find them within each community and work together, because the way that these politicians are kind of using identity to throw us off the scent, that it's the wealthy that we're actually being palmed off by, and the reason why our public services are going down the pan, the reason why we are struggling in our city, that sort of united politics scares people like Zach Goldsmith, I feel. So he will use divisive politics so that we don't see that.
It's certainly part of the wider, I think it's actually disgraceful from Zach Goldsmith's camp actually, playing into this wider narrative of Islamophobia, and that Muslims are somehow answerable to everything that other Muslims have done. I think if Sadiq wasn't a Muslim, this wouldn't have been thrown at him, this thing that he did 12 years ago in his own constituency. But suddenly, because he's on a panel and because he is of the same faith, never mind if he's got completely different politics, completely different worldview to somebody else, he has to answer to it because he's also Muslim. It's bigger than like an identity thing just of Sadiq as well. We're seeing this play out in education, in all sorts of the public sector with the Prevent duty. And that's definitely something that we need to fight. I think it's interesting, though, how Sadiq is using the fact that he's a Muslim in his campaign messaging as how he's the best person to take on extremism. That's very interesting messaging.
Is that a risk, or is it? Do you think it's a positive for trying to discuss these issues candidly and tackle them properly?
I'm not sure. It'd be interesting to see what people think of it and why he feels that he needs to mention it at all in there. Whether he thinks that people are going to pick up on this narrative and be against him because of it. I mean, it's a sorry state of affairs if that's the case, but unfortunately it probably is, and it probably is working against him.
So yeah, having grown up outside the UK and of Muslim and Hindu parentage, how do you feel? Do you wish the Khan campaign hadn't brought this self-identity element into it? And how do you feel about this tone in UK politics?
Well, I think London is one of the most tolerant places anyone could ever wish to live in. I mean, you know, take it from a first-generation immigrant, it is absolutely the case, at least in my experience. Whether or not, how people want to present themselves as a candidate, it must really be entirely down to themselves. Some people might find that that's not something that they want to talk about at all. It might not be important to them. So when Ed Miliband, when he was running his campaign, we've never really heard of religion from him. Clearly it was not something that he was comfortable talking about, or he didn't think it was relevant. Tony Blair famously, I think Alistair Campbell said, "We don't do God." So, that's something that they didn't want to talk about. On the other hand, if Sadiq thinks that that's something that's important to him, that's something that is important to his identity, I think it's quite a personal thing. It has to be up to the campaign. From what I know of London, I find it very difficult to believe that it's going to, that particular thing, that he's a Muslim, is going to, thwart his chances in any way. It might be other things, other policy areas or whatever, but I can't quite imagine that him being a Muslim, that's not the London I have ever experienced. I don't know, other people might have other experiences.
I would agree with you on that, personally, yeah. And I think that people might be put off Sadiq Khan because of other things, such as him funding his campaign through property investors and developers. That is an issue. So he talks a lot about how he's working class and he lived in council housing and all of that jazz, but if you're taking thousands from property developers, where does that leave me as a voter? Where does that leave me thinking? Where are your alliances? Are you going to fight for more social housing? Are you going to fight for rent caps? What are you actually going to do? I think he did say he wants to look into rent caps, but we crowdfunded our campaign, for example, because we wanted it to be off the grassroots and from the people. So I think he should have taken more of a democratic route.
I mean, both the Khan and the Goldsmith campaign seem to be keen to give a sense of prioritising Londoners above people out foreign investment and those outside the city. And this has been a sort of an increasing theme maybe through Ken Boris's mayoralties. Has there been enough to kind of reassure and promote people who are London, London resident, London working? Are you convinced by that in the campaigns?
I think that they're very pro-business, and that, like, as a Londoner for me, is extremely concerning. They might say a lot about, we're for Londoners, we're for this and that, but are they for the working class Londoners who are being pushed out of our city right now? Are they up for fighting the social cleansing that is happening in our city? That's the biggest question. So when, you know, if Sadiq Khan, for example, is going to support the expansion of London City Airport, which is right beside a community that I work in, I run a choir in the community centre right next to the airport, and the respiratory disease that is suffered by Newham residents, you know, like, it is a huge issue, a huge health issue, and the asthma as well is a big issue, then, like, are you really for these Londoners that you speak of? Or are you for a higher class of Londoner, an elite Londoner who can take a private jet from the airport and fly whenever they want to, etc., etc.?
Is there the sense that whether it's been Labour Ken or Tory Boris,
yeah,
it's gone in the same direction?
Precisely.
Over, you know, and that the mayor should be a check on national government and other trends as opposed to encouraging them on business? On another issue now, we've seen a rise over the last year in gang.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Both gang violence and serious youth violence, despite underlying crime trends in decline. Also, Labour has raised the issue of police numbers. They claim declining by 1,535 in the Met under Boris. What is the best... what's the nature of the problem, firstly, with compared to before the London riots... And the last spike in knife crime, which was when Boris came in, and it's a prominent issue. How big a problem is there among London youth, and what's the best answer to it, Kenny?
One of the big issues that a lot of the issues that still remain now are very much social and economical issues, which were taking place before the riots, and they still exist today. The only difference is that now there's just less money, which, if anything, makes the problems even worse. But I think a lot of the issues we've been speaking about today is what breeds a lot of the violence and the gangs that we create in society. For me, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of people have that of this thinking that, yeah, gangs are a symptom of society. Nobody just sort of grows up and think this is exactly what I want to do. It's based on through circumstances, through having negative peer groups and whatnot. And so for me, really, a lot of the issues they need to tackle are things to do with housing, to do with education, better quality teachers. There's a lot of factors that we actually need to solve first before we can even talk about gangs or crime or whatever. The fact of police numbers going down obviously doesn't help. However, prevention, which doesn't really happen in London in terms of investment and services, is appalling. So if you look at youth services in London in particular, it's dropped massively. There's practically no youth services at all, and the youth sector's on its knees, and it's going to be even cut even further as time goes on. So for me, if they continue to do that, then this problem will only get worse.
So there was a 90% cut, I believe, in GLA funding for youth services between 2014 and this current year. Yeah,
and London's got the highest youth unemployment as well. Mm. So a lot of time talk about this stuff about gangs, crime and everything else, but actually we've got some of the biggest problems in the UK that happen in London. We're looking at child homelessness, we're looking at inequality. There's a lot of it, the biggest problems that happen in the capital and elsewhere.
Would it help if the main part of politicians change the language to recognise this and so that crime didn't just fall into this silo and that they did talk about all the economic issues, you know, just to make that change without changing other policies, would that be enough?
No, I think it's not about language, it's about seeing as this whole crime gangs as a public health issue. And big time, a lot of these people they're traumatised and they're not being diagnosed. A lot of them have coming from difficult communities. A lot of them actually come from parents who are actually very well off and there's no issues, but they still find themselves there. And so for me, it's seen as a public health issue and spending time with experts who understand this as opposed to just giving lip service. Boris is just giving the police a lot of powers to do things and implement these schemes, but they haven't been successful. Prevention is much better than cure, and still Boris doesn't get it, neither does MoPac. And until they invest and work with community organisations who do get it, nothing will ever change. We can't have the continuous circles or whatever getting contracts for London and then basically trying to solve our problems.
Do you agree with this view of it as a public health issue? And where's the answer? Is it through money and funding, or is it through where that funding might be directed?
I think some of the things that Kenny's talked about is really important. You know, education, jobs, these are the things that young Londoners worry about. These are the things that any youngster growing up anywhere these days would think about. And I think London is no different at all, really. So everything I've heard here, everything I've ever read or experienced, it is about better engagement. I think role models can play a really important part in showing young people that it's possible to what is possible to do with one's life. I mean, that's always growing up, it can always be confusing, you know, it can always be difficult to choose a path, which one's right, which one's wrong, which one's exciting, which one perhaps is the safest path but probably not, you know, probably a little bit dull. So I think having really good role models, and you know, the media can play a really good role in there in making sure that there are people to look up to, people who can guide people, and that doesn't necessarily have to be in a sort of formulaic way. I think as a society we can do a lot more, and as a community we can do a lot more.
Amina, how do you feel in terms of your local community? And
yeah, like Kenny was talking about youth provision, completely true. All right, the community centre I work in, which is called Asta Community Centre, year on year, it's threatened with closure. And it's got to the point where they need to go to gambling shops to get their money. do you know what I mean? That's how deep it is. Like, the council's not funding it. The youth charity can't afford to fund it anymore. So it's like they have to go to the airport and the gambling shops to fund this centre, but they don't know on the next year if they'll still be there, etc. And these centres, they don't look very pretty sometimes, do you know what I mean? Like, they're old school, they're part of these estates, but they serve as a hub for the community where people can go to when they're at their lowest ebb sometimes and find advice, be it to do with housing or jobs, job training, which is like a huge problem in that area of Newham, especially, like young men who don't know how to get a job will go there and they'll get advice on like CVs, or they'll be able to find out about apprenticeships, or they'll have classes to like further their English, or they'll have cooking lessons. Do you know what I mean? These are all, it's all about investing in young people. So when youth services are cut, or when there's a 90% drop in funding and young people see this around them, they say, I'm not valuable in our society. I think that's the message that our politicians are giving us. And the Take Back the City argument for that is, we need more powers and a bigger budget devolved to London's Assembly, and then we need powers to be devolved to our communities as well, because managers of community centres generally have a very good idea of what's happening in their community, and this all relates to gang violence and stuff and what programmes need to be put in place so that we can engage those young people again and prevent the violence on our streets.
How much can be done at that community level if educational inequalities remain, and with the increasing cost of higher education? Shelley, do you...
Well, it's a massive issue, and I think we've also got to look at the institutional racism that exists in the workplace and in education. You are more likely to be in prison as a young Bangladeshi man than to ever go to university, for instance. So we do need to be talking about investing in all those services, investing in youth services, but actually there's something else going on here where certain types of people aren't getting those opportunities. And I think basically the main political parties are framing it in completely the wrong way by talking about how we need to be spending more on policing, because actually criminalising young people is not the answer. That's actually what's pushing a lot of people into gangs and violence. We need to be giving them ways out. It's about prevention, but it's also about making those ways out accessible to them, rather than things that they don't want to do or they don't know about or they don't have the contacts to get into. And again, like, role models are fantastic, but usually it's the anomaly, the one person that managed to break out, who you're probably never going to be, because they broke out the system against all the odds. We need to take away those odds.
Is there denial or at least embarrassment about this continuing racism, as you describe it? Is that something that we would be loath to admit and want to address because of it sort of goes against what we think about our society?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, yeah, we always talk about how multicultural and diverse London is, and it absolutely is, but there are still huge barriers, huge economic inequalities that exist. And I mean, we have a government that facilitates that as well. I mean, David Cameron only a few years ago talked about how multiculturalism had failed, which I think goes against what a lot of Londoners believe and feel about their own identity as a Londoner.
It's a multicultural debate. Is that still something we should be having, Kenny?
No, to be honest, not really. I guess so. London, you can say, is multicultural. If you go to a lot of different parts of the UK, just really spot the BME there. I think the racism stuff, a lot of people, they're very uncomfortable with that truth, and they prefer to be to deny it or to pretend it doesn't exist. And that's for a lot of people. A lot of people are more concerned about being called racist than with actual racism as a whole.
We're recording this the day after Lord Dobbs's amendment for 3,000 unaccompanied migrant children to be accepted into the UK was turned down, and all of the coverage about that. Should the Mayor of London have a particular message for Syrian refugees and other people escaping conflict in the world? I believe Boris Johnson last year suggested London should accept Syrians in addition to the target that David Cameron had set. Dear, do you have a view on this?
I think this is probably one of the biggest crises of our times, and I'm not sure that it's going to get better anytime soon. So we've really got to find some solutions. I think it's important to look at how much we can take as a city as well, and I think it's important to have that debate, but I'm not sure that anyone's actually started having that debate, really. I think we see a lot of grandstanding around it, but I'm not sure anyone's actually come up with any sort of solutions that's actually going to work. I actually see quite a lot of merit in taking as many children as we possibly can from the actual war-torn areas, because I think that does take away the risk of those really perilous journeys that desperate people make across across the continent trying to get here. And I think it plays into the hands of people smugglers as well, so I think there's something to be said about that. But absolutely we should see how we can do what we can do for all those kids just stuck in that war zone, which is absolutely horrendous. It's just, it begs belief.
I do actually know one example of really good best practice of people actually taking action. And that's at Middlesex University, the student union there linked up with local mosques, synagogues, churches in the Barnet area to talk about what they could do to get the council to resettle 50 Syrian refugees. And so they ran a big campaign with Citizens UK. They did big public open meetings, petitions and everything. And eventually Barnet decided that they would take in 50 Syrian refugees. They would offer them all school places and all housing in the local area. And it was just a few weeks ago that they got a call to say they're on their way, they've packed their bags and they're going to be resettling really soon. And that's a great example of a local community coming together to put pressure on a Tory-run council as well. So I think there's definitely things that other councils in London could do, but also the mayor. There's loads of empty buildings all over the city that could be putting up these people that are desperate for a home, desperate for shelter. And so that's something that I'd love to see some of the candidates say that they do, or they put pressure on local authorities to do as well.
We have, in this election, the Women's Equality Party taking part for the first time and pointing out the 23% pay gap that remains between men and women in London, bigger than in the rest of the UK, and also pushing for companies to adopt quotas for boards within 10 years on a progressive basis. And the party saying that they're having influence on the front runners in terms of their policies towards equality. The three women here, how do you feel about issues on equal pay and of women socially in London, of safety and transport and in public places? We have two male leading candidates, have they recognised that sufficiently?
Quotas for getting women on the board just isn't good enough, and I think it's a very top-down capitalist feminist approach. I think we should be pressuring London companies and employers to be publishing their wages across the board so that they're actually shamed if they're paying women less. This is something I think other countries do, and I think that would go a step towards closing the gap, because people would feel less inclined to actually go and work there if they knew there was a huge sexist gender pay gap. But that's not something I've necessarily seen anybody talk about.
Dear Mina.
It's absolutely crucially important that men and women get the same amount of money for the same sort of the same job that they're doing, not the same sort of, but the same job that they're doing. I don't think anyone in their right mind would quarrel with that at all. So that is hugely important, and we need to make sure that happens. A lot of the time, what also happens is that women are fall behind at certain stages of their lives when they, as a family unit, perhaps take certain decisions. And when we talk about those sort of situations, it's the families, it's the social differences that we really must talk about. So me, for example, if I take my personal experience, I was brought up by my father a lot more than my mother could give me time, because my father was self-employed, my mother wasn't, so she had to go out and work, and I was left with my father quite a bit. And in a Bangladeshi society in the 80s, people laughed at my father quite a bit. My father didn't care at all. But it's wonderful to see that is changing bit by bit now. But if, as a married woman, I say this, I don't know what the status of the other panellists are, if you don't get that support from your family, my mother could only do it because my father was there, not because of anything else, but purely because that family support was there, it's hugely important. And I think as you grow older, it becomes more and more clear that if you don't have your family support, your partner support, you're not going to be able to function. And I think that's what needs to change. And I think in London, if I look at my generation, that has changed to a great extent. I personally know people who are, partners in sort of, top city firms, and their husbands are stay-at-home dads, and they look after their kids. And that's amazing. I think even 10 years ago, that wouldn't have been the norm. It would have been something that, something of an anomaly. So I think things are changing, but I also think that it'll take time, but it is up to us to keep that pressure on.
And costs of childcare, cost of nursery places needs addressing.
Yeah, I think I was looking at some statistic said that you had to earn about, something like 42,000 or something like that as a woman, actually be it, for it to be able to, for it to be worth your while to actually go out and work. So I think, as with everything else, I think deregulation might be something that we look at, that it becomes easier for people to look after children. I think there was one fantastic example that I heard, I think from Germany, where they brought together sort of an old people's home and nursery together, and it meant that children were looked after by, adopted grandparents, if you like. And it was great for both both the groups of people. And now, I'm not saying, you know, this should happen overnight. It's not going to happen overnight. There are serious issues around security, safety, all those sort of things. But I think these are all interesting ideas that we could look at to make sure that the solutions come from the communities and the society.
I think that, yeah, like, obviously women should be getting equal pay to men. But, like, the war that the Tories have waged on women through their cuts is insane. Like, women bear the brunt of all of these policies more than men, and I think that needs to be recognised more by parties as well. And as a result of this, we can see single mothers being pushed out of temporary accommodation that they've been moved into because they're homeless. You know, Focus E15, their campaign, let's look at that. What about Sisters Uncut and their amazing campaign against domestic violence? Mm-hmm. Because women who can't find a home, being made homeless, like not being able to choose where they live, you know, and making sure them and all their children are safe, that's insane. And like, this government has done nothing to like make women feel safe at all. So the pay thing, yeah, that's one thing, but also we need to look at like the cuts that are being made as well, because they're affecting women more than men.
There's one thing the mayor could do. Boris Johnson, when he became mayor, got rid of the department which looked specifically at women's issues. Mm-hmm. I think there was one commissioner or something, and he scrapped it. So bringing that back would be good, but there's also only one local authority in the whole city which has a cabinet member whose postholder it's for women's safety specifically. Mm-hmm. So expanding these kind of roles where we've actually got dedicated research and, you know, political leadership on women's issues would be at least a start.
Does it matter that we have, of the front runners, Sadiq Khan proudly proclaiming he's a feminist and Zach Oldness saying that he'd never call himself a feminist? Kenny, would that change your feelings about either of them?
Not really. I guess being a feminist, agreeing with the fact that you believe that women should be equal with men economically, politically, socially. Yeah, if somebody's not actually for that, I should be a bit worried. but yeah, I guess that's what being a feminist is. Doesn't mean I'm going to necessarily be campaigning to about what life's like being a woman, because obviously I'm not. But I guess it's being alive to it and being aware and just supporting what you know is right.
If our representatives are afraid of calling themselves feminists, then I want to touch them with a barge pole. That's how I feel about that.
It's also about what you do though, as well as what you say. Like, it's great that Sadiq sees himself as a feminist, but I want to know what he's going to do for women.
Thank you, you've been all fantastic. Kenny, Shelley, Nina, Dia, I hope you tune in to the next London Elections podcast. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.